America would have been accepting surrender from Konstantin Chernenko in 1985, and Time magazine could have made him Man of the Year. Apart from Reagan's inner circle, no one alive between World War II and the Reagan presidency could have imagined such a magnificent conclusion to the Cold War. Reagan was the first authentic conservative in the White House in over 50 years. That's all it took. It was not a coincidence that Reagan succeeded where his predecessors had failed. In 1984, the New York Times national security correspondent, Leslie Gelb, described Reagan's transformation of Cold War tactics. Fight and win are new words in the lexicon of governmental nuclear strategy. Prior administrations, Gelb said, had used words like preventing defeat or avoiding an unfavorable outcome to describe their belief that there could be no winners in a nuclear war. The Reagan administration proposed something different. Reagan was actually seeking to win a nuclear war. Gelb labeled this shift lamentable. The New York Times style book expressed contempt for the idea of winning the Cold War by requiring these words to be placed in quote marks: superiority, win, evil empire, freedom fighters, soft on communism, and backing down. This was in contradistinction to precise adjectives like warmonger, unwinnable conflict, dangerous, or simple-minded, none of which took quotes. There is no question but that the Reagan doctrine was completely at odds with those of his predecessors, and no question but that liberals were hopping mad about it. Reagan had been floating the idea of victory for years. When he challenged President Ford in the 1976 Republican primary, he accused Ford of fighting the Cold War like a Democrat. The media instantly leapt to Ford's defense, with The Economist pompously intoning, "The accusation that Mr. Ford neglects defense is absurd." Reagan attacked Ford's Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, with particular vigor. In 1976, Kissinger proclaimed, "We cannot prevent the growth of Soviet power." Kissinger promoted what he called the imperative of coexistence and cautioned Americans not to mesmerize themselves with the illusion of simple solutions. Reagan had one of those simple solutions. He thought we should win and the Soviets should lose. Détente, Reagan said, is what a farmer has with his turkey until Thanksgiving Day. Reagan's ridicule of Kissinger's policies was so successful that President Ford had to order his campaign to stop using the word détente. In his book Diplomacy, Kissinger stated categorically that Reagan was the first American president to present a direct moral challenge to the Soviet Union, which he described as an enormous difference from prior administrations. Reagan waged the Cold War with relish. For every missile the Soviets built, America would build two. Despite caterwauling of liberal peace protesters, Reagan installed Pershing missiles in Europe. He invaded communist-controlled Grenada, clearing out a nest of Marxists in a few days. He openly supported anti-communist forces around the world, in Angola, Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Poland, and Nicaragua. In May 1982, Reagan signed a secret order, National Security Decision Directive 32, to destabilize the communist regime in Poland. In a covert compact with the Pope, what Reagan's first national security advisor, Richard Allen, called one of the great secret alliances of all time, Reagan provided aid to Solidarity, the anti-communist union outlawed in Poland. With money from the CIA, the National Endowment for Democracy, secret Vatican bank accounts, and Western trade unions, Solidarity stirred up a lot of trouble for the Soviets in their Polish Republic. The Reagan administration relentlessly opposed Moscow in every part of the world, in every way, on every front, in every form imaginable. Aiding anti-communist efforts abroad raised the price of Soviet expansionism and weakened the USSR militarily, economically, and psychologically. The Soviet Union was already devoting a huge proportion of its anemic gross national product to military production. The Kremlin couldn't meet the Reagan buildup. Contrary to cheery reports in the American media, the Soviet economy was a basket case. Reagan made it worse. He imposed a trade embargo on Russian goods. He deregulated oil and slashed the Carter-era inflation rate from 10.4% in 1980 to 4.2% in 1988. When oil prices plummeted under Reagan, the Soviets were strapped for hard currency. Reagan's unrelenting pressure on the Soviet economy forced the USSR to begin withdrawing its troops and largesse from aspiring Marxist dictatorships abroad. Still, the Soviet Union could have stumbled along for a few more decades, waiting out the Reagan administration and hoping for a Democrat president to come in and help the Soviets restore their hegemony. But Reagan wasn't going to let the USSR outlast him. The last great battle of the Cold War was fought in Reykjavik, Iceland, on October 13, 1986. That was the day Reagan refused to accede to Mikhail Gorbachev's demand that the United States abandon the Strategic Defense Initiative. The Soviets were terrified of Star Wars, a terror that was palpable on the editorial pages of the New York Times. For the Soviet Union to survive, Gorbachev had to snooker Reagan into abandoning a missile defense system. This was not offensive weaponry. Reagan even offered to share the technology with the USSR. But without the credible threat of being able to launch a nuclear strike against the United States, the USSR was just another third world country. Star Wars would make the USSR's nuclear weapons obsolete. The Soviet Union would be no more threatening than Switzerland, and a less appealing place to live. Consequently, Gorbachev offered vast, unprecedented arms reductions at Reykjavik, on the sole condition that Reagan abandon a missile defense system. Reagan refused. As he boarded Air Force One out of Reykjavik, Reagan said his aim was not agreement, but victory. The ultimate goal of American foreign policy, he said, is not just the prevention of war, but the expansion of freedom. At Reykjavik, the world saw the difference between Reagan's doctrine of victory and his predecessor's policies of deterrence, détente, and containment. All major U.S. media went berserk at Reagan's refusal to give up the Strategic Defense Initiative. The New York Times angrily lashed out at SDI, calling it utopian and inconceivable. Gorbachev's turgid response was highlighted as the Times' quotation of the day. After Reykjavik, it is clear to everyone that SDI is a symbol of obstruction to the cause of peace, the epitome of militarist schemes, and the unwillingness to remove the nuclear menace to mankind. There can be no other interpretation of it, and this is the most important lesson from the meeting in Reykjavik. Time magazine ran a cover story titled, "Sunk by Star Wars." The magazine petulantly snipped that Reagan could have signed the most sweeping arms control agreement in the history of the nuclear age. Alas, he had queered the deal for the sake of his cherished Strategic Defense Initiative. Members of the scientific community did their part for America by vowing to accept no research funds to help the United States develop a missile defense shield. It wasn't clear why Reagan's idea of protecting America from incoming missiles was such a bad idea, except from the perspective of America's enemies. The opinion cartel's insistence that Reagan capitulate on Star Wars leaves no doubt as to whose side they were on. When contemplating a shield that would protect America from incoming missiles, Democrats suddenly become hard-headed fiscal conservatives. For the first time in recorded history, liberals were concerned about the cost and usefulness of a government program. These people believe federally funded art therapy for the homeless will pay for itself. That you can take to the bank. But a shield to repel incoming nuclear missiles from American soil, they said, was too expensive and wouldn't work. Reagan had spent 6 years bleeding the Soviet Union from every limb. By walking away from the table at Reykjavik, rather than abandon SDI, Reagan consigned the USSR to the dustbin of history. His victory over the evil empire was complete. The rest was paperwork. In 1988, the American people paid Reagan one final tribute by electing his vice president, George Bush, to the presidency in a landslide vote. In 1989, the Soviets pulled their troops out of Afghanistan. On November 9, 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. On July 6, 1990, NATO announced that the Soviet Union was no longer an adversary. The rest of the year, one by one, the republics of the Soviet Union declared their independence. Finally, on December 26, 1991, the USSR was formally dissolved. To be sure, by refusing to compromise on Star Wars, Reagan had abandoned hope of ever winning a Nobel Peace Prize. it must have provided some consolation to know that he had forever destroyed the Soviet war machine on behalf of the entire free world. Perhaps recognizing the futility of claiming that the Soviet Union collapsed when Truman's containment policy kicked in 3 decades later, some liberals give all the credit to Mikhail Gorbachev for deciding to surrender. Liberals viewed Gorbachev as a reformer because he was the first Soviet leader whose wife weighed less than he did. By the time Gorbachev came to power in March 1985, he took the reins of a severely weakened Soviet Union faced with a formidable adversary. Still, Gorbachev didn't surrender right away. He kept Russian troops in Afghanistan and, most importantly, in 1986, demanded that Reagan abandon his plan for a missile defense shield. But Gorbachev is a hero because, in lieu of launching a bonsai nuclear attack, he surrendered. Thus, Joseph Nye, director of the Kennedy School of Government's Center for International Affairs, sportingly admitted that Reagan deserves some of the credit for ending the Cold War. But Gorbachev, he said, probably deserves twice as much credit for his blunders. A columnist for the Chicago Tribune cited an erstwhile Soviet apparatchik for the proposition that Reagan actually played a negative role in ending the Cold War. The Soviet official credited Reagan only for being ready when Gorbachev initiated his new policy to join in. And the Soviets really did have 70 years of barren harvest because of bad weather. Newsweek's Jonathan Alter praised Mikhail Gorbachev in terms that would make the Soviet toady blush. He's only the most important political leader alive in the world today, historically speaking. If you look over the course of our lifetimes, who was the most? Well, you go back to Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. If I look back over my lifetime, who was the world leader who changed things the most? And I don't actually think it is a close call. It's curious that no Soviet premier had grabbed this opportunity for glory by relinquishing his empire in the previous 70 years. If you were setting a half-bright trap to collect a half-bright menagerie, you couldn't do better than saying Reagan won the Cold War and waiting to see who argues with you. It's the verbal equivalent of a box, a stick, and a piece of cheese. Oh, look, I got a Jonathan Alter, and here's a Phil Donahue. Even the New York Times finally admitted Reagan won the Cold War in a 2002 news article that said, President Reagan's aggressive posture against the former Soviet Union in the 1980s was a stance that succeeded so well it is now beyond debate. When Whitaker Chambers left the Communist Party, he said communism would triumph because conservatives could never match the communists' intensity of faith. The only hope, he said, was for the free world to discover a power of faith which will provide man's mind at the same intensity with the same two certainties, a reason to live and a reason to die. After he wrote those words, a Hollywood actor read them and would soon register as a Republican for the first time in his life. Some 3 decades later, that actor would become president of the United States. In his first press conference as president, Reagan said of the Soviet Union, "The only morality they recognize is what will further their cause, meaning they reserve unto themselves the right to commit any crime, to lie, to cheat." Reporters were duly mortified by such gaucherie and asked Reagan if he wouldn't like to clarify his remarks. He did, but not the way they had in mind. He continued, saying the Soviets don't subscribe to our sense of morality. They don't believe in an afterlife. They don't believe in a god or a religion. And the only morality they recognize, therefore, is what will advance the cause of socialism. Reagan's victory was more than a dry calculation of throw weights and ICBMs and military might. He did nothing less than transform America's mission. Under Reagan, Kissinger wrote, America's goal was no longer relaxation of tensions, but crusade and conversion. After receiving mash notes from the New York Times for 4 years, the Soviets were ill-prepared for Reagan's moral assault. In one of the great speeches of Western civilization, on March 8, 1983, Reagan addressed the National Association of Evangelicals and said America was at war with an evil empire. Echoing Whitaker Chambers, Reagan said the Cold War would never be decided by bombs or rockets, by armies or military might. It was America's belief in God that would terrify and ultimately triumph over those who would enslave their fellow man. We would prevail because our strength is not material but spiritual. Sovietologist Sigourney Bialar reported that by 1984, Reagan's rhetoric had badly shaken the self-esteem and patriotic pride of the Soviet political elites. The Reagan administration's self-righteous moralistic tone, its reduction of Soviet achievements to crimes by international outlaws from an evil empire, such language stunned and humiliated the Soviet leaders. Bialer said the Kremlin was astounded to discover that Reagan seemed determined to deny the Soviet Union nothing less than its legitimacy and status as a global power. This was something they thought had been conceded once and for all by Reagan's predecessors. For 20 years, the country had been on a downward spiral of defeat and demoralization. Race riots, civil rights battles, rampant drug use, sexual promiscuity, Vietnam, all these had crushed the moral certainty that the free world could win, or even that it should. Reagan's invincible faith in God and freedom ignited the will of the American people to defeat Soviet totalitarianism. He said communism was not merely an improbable economic system, but evil. The final lines in Reagan's 1987 speech at the Berlin Wall were these: "Across Europe, this wall will fall, for it cannot withstand faith, it cannot withstand truth, this wall cannot withstand freedom." Reagan supplied the intensity of faith Whitaker Chambers despaired of the free world ever mustering. "The Western world does not know it," Chambers said, "but it already possesses the answer to communism, but only if its faith in God is as great as communism's faith in man." In 1984, Reagan posthumously awarded Whitaker Chambers the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Liberals still don't understand the role religious faith played in the West's victory over communism. Reagan's faith is smirkingly dismissed, as if it amounted to nothing more than bright and sunny optimism, the equivalent of a peppy Madison Avenue jingle selling dog food. It wasn't just military might or a preference for the materialist bounty of capitalism that drove Reagan's victory over communism. It was Americans choosing faith in God over faith in man. Only Reagan could give Americans a reason to live and a reason to die. He wasn't lucky. He was indispensable. Chapter 9. Liberals in Love, Mash Notes to the Kremlin. Reagan came to power announcing that the last chapter of communism was then being written. He said the West would transcend the Soviet Union, which would soon be remembered only as a sad, bizarre chapter in human history. The sophisticate said he was out of his mind and would blow up the world. Then when he won, Reagan was no longer frightening, merely non-germane. History professor Alan Brinkley said the belief that Reagan won the Cold War was an article of faith among many Reagan admirers. But historians, he said, believe the end of the Cold War had more to do with the grave internal weaknesses in the Soviet system. And that's why every college professor, editorial writer, and Hollywood activist in America was howling about Reagan's Cold War policies throughout his 8 years in office. That's why they were screeching that Reagan was leading us to the brink of nuclear holocaust. That's why they were demanding unilateral disarmament and passing out Nobel Peace Prizes to one another for their piercing conclusions that Reagan was scaring the Soviet Union and must be stopped. All that was because the Soviet Union was a dreary old collapsing wreck of an empire anyway. Just kidding about our hysterical jeremiads. In 1994, Newsweek's Eleanor Clift explained why liberals had been completely wrong about everything they ever said about the Cold War. Apparently, there was a vast CIA cover-up during the Reagan administration that cunningly concealed facts only from liberals. She said, "People who want to give Ronald Reagan the entire credit for the collapse of the Soviet Union ignore the fact that the Soviet economy was collapsing, and the Reagan administration covered it up. The CIA concealed what was happening over there so they could keep the defense budget over here high." The CIA will not cease in its infernal efforts to conceal information about communist dictatorships from Eleanor. Discussing whether Elian Gonzalez should be sent back to Cuba during the Clinton administration, she said, "Frankly, to be a poor child in Cuba may, in many instances, be better than being a poor child in Miami." If the Soviet Union was disintegrating under the force of its own grave internal weaknesses, as Professor Brinkley summarized the modern view, no one seemed to know it at the time. That theory first emerged after the Soviet Union collapsed, when and how Reagan said it would. If Reagan was just the night watchman for an empire in decline, it would have saved everyone a lot of trouble if liberals had told us that at the time. Quite the contrary, liberals were in a state of hysterical paranoia at the totemic symbol of Ronald Reagan. President Jimmy Carter's principal campaign theme against Reagan was to repeatedly use the words dangerous and disturbing in connection with Reagan's foreign policy. Strobe Talbot, Time Magazine's Washington bureau chief, arms control expert, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State under Clinton, and pompous octogenarian blowhard before he was 19 years old, analyzed American foreign policy just 1 month into Reagan's presidency. He began by noting that the Soviet Union was stronger and bolder than ever before. This was Reagan's first year in office when, as we are now told, the Soviet Union was collapsing of its own grave internal weaknesses. Stronger than ever. Thus, Talbot advised, the U.S. must learn to live with parity. Whether America likes it or not, Leonid Brezhnev is quite correct in describing any U.S. quest for nuclear supremacy as misguided. The U.S. cannot get there from here, not against a Soviet Union that is ready and able to match America in any kind of arms race. A widely cited 1983 study conducted by 35 Soviet experts from Harvard, Columbia, Cornell, and other elite institutions predicted, the Soviet Union is going to remain a stable state, with a very stable, conservative, immobile government. We don't see any collapse or weakening of the Soviet system. The Soviet Union was certainly not behaving like a power in decline when Reagan entered the Oval Office. Soviet hegemony had been steadily advancing for 60 years. Over 1 billion people lived under communism. American policy toward the Soviets had gone from rollback to containment to detente and was rapidly approaching acceptable defeat. In 1980, Soviet expert Adam Ulam of Harvard remarked, "For the last 3 or 4 years, the Soviets have been led to believe they can get away with anything." About the same time, former President Richard Nixon published a book, The Real War, in which he announced that World War III had already begun and the Soviet Union was winning. The Soviets' relentless expansionism and prodigious military buildup, he wrote, would force Americans to face two cold realities for the first time in modern history in the coming decade. The first is that, if war were to come, we might lose. The second is that we might be defeated without war. To be sure, communism's capacity to produce goods and services was not without flaw. Even liberals were beginning to question whether the Soviet farmer had really suffered 70 years of bad weather. But the Soviet Union was never a superpower because of its booming economy. It was a superpower because of its military might. The USSR had nuclear weapons pointed at U.S. soil and outnumbered the U.S. in conventional arms by a ratio of about 3-1. Indeed, even on Reagan's watch, the Soviets did not behave like a doomed carcass of an empire. Unaware of the revisionist history liberals would someday be trying to pawn off on an unwitting public, the Soviet Union carpet-bombed Afghanistan, smashed Solidarity in Poland, shot down a civilian plane with Americans aboard, and then decorated the pilot who did it. There is powerful evidence that the Soviets, working through the Bulgarians, put out a murder contract on the Pope, who was collaborating with the Reagan administration to support Solidarity. The experts browbeat the public into believing nuclear war was imminent. Citing a variety of recent opinion polls, the New York Times reported that a substantial plurality of Americans believe nuclear war will occur within the next few years. There was no nuclear war, and now there is no Soviet Union. The opinion cartel was not just wrong. It was selling a bad product. Assuredly, the world stage might not have permitted much hope that the Soviet Union was headed for the ash heap of history, as Reagan had said. But liberals weren't angry at Reagan's policies. They were angry at his objectives. Judging by their positions at the time, rather than their post hoc allegations, Democrats adored the Soviet Union. Congressional Democrats repeatedly opposed funding anti-communist rebels. They opposed Reagan's military buildup. They opposed developing a shield to protect America from incoming missiles. They opposed putting missiles in Europe. As a rule of thumb, Democrats opposed anything opposed by the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union did not like the idea of a militarily strong America. Neither did the Democrats. In 1982, Senator Edward Kennedy said the arms race rushes ahead toward nuclear confrontation that could well mean the annihilation of the human race. Run, natives of Swaziland, run! Former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance said Reagan was not dealing seriously with the problems, but was engaging in needlessly provocative bear baiting. Walter Mondale, whom the Democrats considered presidential material, steadfastly opposed defense spending. In the 1984 presidential debates, Mondale explained that he had opposed the F-14 fighter, the M-1 tank, the B-1 bomber, even an increase in military salaries, because he wanted to make certain that a dollar spent buys us a dollar's worth of defense. Democrats are never so penurious about taxpayer money as when it comes to the defense of the nation. All organs of elite opinion were in hysteria about Reagan's military buildup, which buildup defeated the Soviets when they couldn't keep up and it wrecked their economy. In 1980, the New York Times self-righteously sniffed that Reagan seems genuinely to believe that the vain pursuit of armed superiority will bring the Russians begging to the bargaining table. It did. The Times sneered at Reagan's bluster, bravado, and refusal to recognize that America is no longer, if it ever was, king of the world. We weren't, but thanks to Reagan, now we are. Reagan, the Times said, is easily caricatured as a bellicose ideologue lacking depth, complexity, and subtlety. And yet, the Times said, Reagan was dangerous. What danger? The Soviet Union was on its last legs. In a follow-up editorial the next day, the Times again reminded its readers, for the 4 billionth time, that Reagan was dangerous and stupid. Mr. Reagan still pretends that a rapid buildup of nuclear weapons could frighten the Russians with the specter of American superiority. It did. Without Reagan, we would still be listening to Helen Caldicott drone on about nuclear winter. Throughout the Reagan administration, there was no tinpot communist dictator who did not instantly become the latest celebrity accoutrement in Beverly Hills and the Hamptons. Nicaraguan despot Daniel Ortega was the most desirable dinner guest in Hollywood, forcing him to cut back on denouncing Zionists for a while. Hollywood entertainers formed the Pro-Ortega Committee of Concern, chaired by actor Mike Farrell, whose wisdom in foreign policy was, reassuringly, shaped by his years as a co-star on TV's MASH. They held lush poolside fundraisers at celebrity homes for Ortega, this man of the people. Mrs. George Slaff, wife of the former mayor of Beverly Hills, hosted one of the star-studded events for Ortega. She explained to a reporter that she was not bothered by the Marxist enthusiasm for eradicating the rich, because that's their business. I don't regard them as a threat to my way of life or to the United States. Mrs. Slaff was insulated from communist tyranny herself, but she thought it might be nice for the little brown brothers. There was no reason to imagine anyone else might want to live in a Beverly Hills estate, with the rhododendrons and the pools and Juanita the maid serving bottled water. Other Hollywood celebrities for communist dictators included actors Ed Asner, Michael Douglas, Diane Ladd, Bob Foxworth, Elizabeth Bewitched Montgomery, and singer Jackson Brown. Following protocol, the celebrities were duly praised for, quote, risking their careers by taking a public stand on a politically controversial matter. It was a display of raw courage not seen since George Washington's shivering troops endured the winter at Valley Forge. If Reagan didn't win the Cold War, did Ed Asner win it? Famous blowhards were constantly impressing other famous blowhards with the greater calamity they could predict resulting from Reagan's support for anti-communist guerrillas. Joan Didion hysterically berated the Reagan administration for the wreckage it was leaving in Nicaragua. Eventually, she said, it would be necessary to talk about Reagan's Latin American policy and when the levers would again be pulled and the consequences voided. The wreckage left by the Reagan administration, referred to by Didion, is that Nicaragua is a free country that now holds elections. While Reagan called Nicaragua a totalitarian dungeon, the Democrats saw Ortega as an indigenous reformer. Democratic Senators Tom Harkin and John Kerry flew to Managua to meet with Ortega and returned claiming Ortega was a misunderstood Democrat rather than a Marxist autocrat. In the end, the Democrat-controlled House voted down even humanitarian aid for the Contras in a vote of 248-180. Havana Radio hailed the vote as a catastrophic defeat for Reagan. Communists in Havana and the United States Congress had barely recovered from their victory party when, on April 29th, less than a week after Democrats had voted down even humanitarian aid for the Contras, Ortega flew to Moscow to meet with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. Still, the Democrats put on a brave face. Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd glibly said, "Where does a Marxist go? Disney World? West Palm Beach?" While Democrats were all but offering their daughters to Ortega, Reagan called the Contra rebels the moral equals of our founding fathers. Reagan was so desperate to get aid to the anti-communist rebels in 1985 that at the last minute he even agreed to sweeten the pot for Democrats by limiting the aid to humanitarian purposes, food, medicine, clothing, and other assistance. Then Senate Minority Leader and former Klansman Robert Byrd complained that the other assistance phrase was big enough for an Amtrak train to go through and could very well involve trucks and earth-moving equipment. That's how much the Democrats hated the Contras. No trucks. The general theme of the Democratic opposition to aiding the Contras was to keep prattling about Vietnam. They wistfully longed for a Democratic president who could lose wars for America. Any aid granted the Contras was treated as the functional equivalent of putting American boys in body bags. Democratic Senator John Glenn compared the paltry $14 million Reagan had requested to President Lyndon Johnson's expansion of the war in Vietnam. "It's an advanced Gulf of Tonkin resolution if I've ever heard one." The Democratic chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Representative Lee Hamilton, said, "There is a better way to deal with our problems in Nicaragua than by fighting this nasty little war." Evidently, sending money for food and medicine was not among the unspecified better ways. The Democrats always had mysterious objections and secret better ways, which they would never tell us. Then they would vote whichever way would best advance communist interests. The next year, Reagan again pleaded with Congress to fund the Contras. White House Communications Director Pat Buchanan said Congress could vote with the Contras or vote with the communists. The reaction was predictable. The Washington Post's Mary McGrory instantly denounced Buchanan for such ugly tactics. "Telling the truth about Democrats is an ugly tactic." Democratic Congressman Tony Coelho proposed that Democrats vote against the Contras to punish Pat Buchanan, saying a vote for the Contras would be a ratification of Buchanan's red-baiting tactics. Liberals think they should be able to root for the Reds without anyone being so uncouth as to point out they are rooting for the Reds. In one of the most stirring episodes of U.S. history, faced with the Democrats' refusal to fund anti-Marxists in Nicaragua, members of Reagan's staff devised a brilliant plan to support the Contras with private donations. Funds were collected from patriotic Americans, various foreign countries, the Sultan of Brunei, and private organizations. In addition, Israel sold arms to Iran, and a portion of the proceeds was diverted to the beleaguered Contras. Israel had its own reasons for wanting to sell arms to the Iranians, then at war with Iraq. Israel worked with moderates within the Iranian government, who offered, as a bonus, to pressure Islamic Jihad to release American hostages recently kidnapped in Beirut. But that was icing on the cake. The main operation consisted of helping two heinous regimes bleed each other a little longer while getting money to anti-communists battling totalitarian tyrants in Nicaragua. This is what could be accomplished by bypassing the sedition lobby in Congress. As the MasterCard commercial says, priceless. When the Democrats got wind of the fact that men on the president's staff had been secretly promoting the national interest, they were blind with rage. They would have been fine with a private operation to fund needle exchanges for drug addicts. But diverting money to anti-communist rebels was a constitutional crisis. Democrats raised a hue and cry, alleging a technical violation of the Boland Amendment, which no one could ever understand. There were hearings and indictments and millions of dollars spent on a special prosecutor. Democrats had not felt so alive since they used Watergate to abandon Vietnam in the dark of night, relinquishing Southeast Asia to totalitarian monsters. In retelling the glorious story of how the Democrats won the Cold War, let it never be forgotten that the indictment in the Iran-Contra case charged, "In or before the middle of 1985, the defendants Oliver L. North, Richard V. Secord, and Albert Hakem, and others commenced an enterprise that was intended, among other things, to support military and paramilitary operations in Nicaragua by the Contras and to conduct covert action operations." Democrats thought it should be a criminal offense to give aid to anti-communists. President George Bush did not agree and years later would pardon the Iran-Contra participants, who stood accused of conspiring for freedom. Sad to say, Reagan never knew about the Iran-Contra plan until his attorney general, Edwin Meese, discovered it and informed the press. The principals of the operation promptly resigned or were fired. Reagan was hopping mad about Iran offering to pressure Islamic Jihad to release American hostages. That was too close to negotiating for hostages, something Reagan said he would never do. But even if corners were cut, it was a brilliant scheme. There is no possibility that anyone in any Democratic administration would have gone to such lengths to fund anti-communist forces. When Democrats scheme from the White House, it's to cover up the president's affair with an intern. When Republicans scheme, it's to support embattled anti-communist freedom fighters sold out by the Democrats. Fascinatingly, the one event during the Reagan administration that shook the Soviet leadership more than any other was the invasion of Grenada, opposed by liberals. The New York Times matter-of-factly reported that the Grenada invasion was seen as a setback for the Democrats. The media compared the liberation of Grenada to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. The Times raged that Reagan was making the world safe for hypocrisy for having the audacity to free Grenada from Soviet stooges. The Times also reminded readers that Reagan was a cowboy, ready to shoot at the drop of a hat. College protesters openly rooted for the other side. While the liberated people of Grenada greeted American troops with open arms, liberals saw the invasion as American imperialism. The Soviet press simply demeaned the Grenada invasion as a meaningless non-event. TASS, the official newspaper of the Soviet government, smirked that the Pentagon successfully seized the tiny island with the help of a whole armada of naval ships, helicopters, planes, artillery, and detachments of Marines. The New York Times, the unofficial paper of the Soviet government, smirked that the so-called heroes had triumphed over some 750 Cubans and their Grenadian allies on what is, after all, only a tiny island. This was, the Times said, not a major gain. Liberals only think it counts as a real war if America loses. The party that lost China was not exactly in a position to be complaining about the square footage of the territory Reagan won back, but in any event, Grenada was more significant than its territory. Grenada marked the point at which Reagan had unquestionably broken the defeatism of Vietnam. When informed that the United Nations had condemned the Grenada invasion, Reagan said, "It didn't upset my breakfast at all." Despite daily harangues in the New York Times, polls showed Americans overwhelmingly supported the Grenada invasion. The Soviets were shocked and disheartened to discover that the editorial positions of the New York Times did not accurately reflect the sentiments of the American people. Even as Reagan's policies were working, liberals denied it. New York Times columnist Flora Lewis scoffed at Jean Kirkpatrick's remarkable claim, made during the 1984 Republican National Convention, that the Russians had nearly taken over until the Reagan administration. Where, Lewis demanded to know. As Ambassador Kirkpatrick said in her speech just a sentence or two later, in the decade preceding Reagan's inauguration, the Soviets had expanded their influence into South Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Angola, Ethiopia, Mozambique, South Yemen, Libya, Syria, Aden, the Congo, Madagascar, the Seychelles, Nicaragua, and Grenada. Other than that, no place really. In addition to the military offensives, Reagan directed an unremitting stream of rhetorical attacks at the Kremlin. Liberals were horribly embarrassed by Reagan's bellicose anti-communism. In the 1984 presidential campaign, Mondale said Reagan's support for anti-communist rebels in Nicaragua had embarrassed us. Supporting the Contras, Mondale said, had strengthened our opposition and undermined America's moral authority. Apparently, it made our enemies mad. You wouldn't want that in the middle of an epic struggle with communist totalitarians. Mondale said Reagan was oversimplifying the difficulties of what we must do in Central America. Liberals always have complicated long-term solutions that require doing short-term what our enemies would like us to do. Even newspapers that endorsed Reagan claimed to be embarrassed by him. The Chicago Tribune endorsed Reagan over Mondale in 1984, but criticized the president for his ignorance about the Soviet Union and his airheaded rhetoric on the issues of foreign policy and arms control. Needless to say, liberals reacted to Reagan's evil empire speech with apoplexy. After asking the evangelical audience to pray for those who lived under totalitarian rule, Reagan said that as long as the Kremlin continued to preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world. Liberals now brush off Reagan's evil empire speech as slightly ludicrous and utterly irrelevant. They were not so complacent at the time, and as we now know, neither were the Russians. The New York Times alone ran over a dozen articles on Reagan's evil empire speech. Liberals were appalled at Reagan's churlish words toward their beloved Soviet Union, as well as his simplistic assumption that we could win the Cold War. James Reston, writing for the Times, was baffled by the objective of violent criticism of Russians as an evil society. As pop icon Sting sang, "The Russians love their children too." Times columnist Tom Wicker denounced the evil empire speech as evidencing a dangerous doctrine inviting a repetition of the Vietnam experience. In case readers of the New York Times were not yet stockpiling cyanide pills in raw terror at Reagan's evil empire speech, still another editorial writer weighed in on the speech. Russell Baker said Reagan offered only a bleak, bankruptive vision of the American future. Showing the prescience that has come to define the New York Times op-ed page, Baker said Reagan's Cold War policies raised the specter of the next century consumed with war against the evil empire of communism. There was no happy ending in the cards, no ending of any variety. Just eternity stretching on and on with the bills coming in forever. A few years later, a Democratic Congress would be cheerfully blowing Reagan's peacetime dividend on comically useless domestic programs. Further obscuring the idea that the Soviet Union was a moldering old corpse of a country, when Reagan made a joke about the Soviet Union in August 1984, the entire liberal cult went ballistic. The jokester Reagan warmed up his radio mic before a presidential address saying, "My fellow Americans, I am pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes." The New York Times rushed to print with a 1,000-word article on Reagan's gaffe. John B. Oakes, former senior editor of the Times, warned that Reagan's joke reflects an instinctive feeling that the only good Russian is a dead Russian, which is a rather dangerous sentiment to be boiling along under the presidential skin in this hair-trigger age. Unnamed State Department and White House officials called the incident an embarrassment. In general, there was a lot of indignation about a country that was, as we are now told, teetering on the brink of collapse, completely independent of anything Reagan said or did. The argument that Reagan didn't know what he was doing when he won the Cold War proves nothing more than that liberals will lie about anything. There is not a shred of evidence to support it other than the left's all-consuming hatred for Ronald Reagan. For a man who was buffeted on all sides with contradictory advice for 8 years in office, Reagan certainly had a knack for always choosing to take the right advice at just the right moment. When an advance copy of Reagan's Berlin Wall speech was circulated, it was vehemently opposed by virtually the entire foreign policy apparatus of the U.S. government, according to the draft's author, speechwriter Peter Robinson. Robinson says there were telephone calls, memoranda, and meetings. State and the NSC submitted their own alternative drafts. In each, the call for Gorbachev to tear down the wall was missing. Right up until the moment Reagan boarded Air Force One for Berlin, the State Department and National Security Council were faxing over alternative drafts. The problem was, Robinson said, Reagan liked the speech. He especially liked the part about the wall. When initially asked for his comments on the speech, Reagan said, "Well, there's that passage about tearing down the wall. That wall has to come down. That's what I'd like to say." So that's what he said. The phrase remained, Robinson says, solely because of Ronald Reagan. Moments before giving the speech, Reagan was told that a crowd of East Berliners gathered on the opposite side of the wall to hear his speech had been scattered by the East German police. So when he came to the passage about the wall, he pounded out each syllable. "General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Reagan not only ignored the liberal elite throughout his administration, but when necessary, he ignored his conservative base, too. He did so rather famously in 1987, when his apocryphal senility should have been in full bloom, if that hadn't been a vicious lie. A little more than a year after Reagan walked away from the negotiating table in Reykjavik, he suddenly switched course and began playing good cop with Gorbachev. He even agreed to sign a treaty banning medium-range missiles from Europe. Conservatives went bananas. They finally thought maybe liberals were right about Reagan's encroaching dementia. William F. Buckley Jr.'s National Review called the prospective treaty a catastrophic venture in utopianism. The Wall Street Journal criticized Reagan for making a bad deal and subjecting our European allies to Soviet intimidation. Conservative caucus chairman Howard Phillips ridiculed Reagan as a useful idiot for Kremlin propaganda, saying he was little more than the speech reader-in-chief. This was one of the rare instances when the New York Times allows the likes of a genuine conservative like Phillips to grace its editorial page, to attack Reagan. Reagan ignored his fellow conservatives. He knew he had already won at Reykjavik, and that it was time to make overtures to Gorbachev. Once again, Reagan was right and others were wrong. By pursuing his own course, Ronald Reagan achieved the final triumph over Soviet communism. After Reagan brought down the Iron Curtain, by steadfastly ignoring everything liberals said, you would think erstwhile Soviet enthusiasts would stay mum on the subject of their prior positions. Instead, they tell wild, bald-faced lies about how they had recognized early on the true nature of Soviet communism. As Norman Mailer remembered it, he had been dubious about the Soviet Union all along. In 1996, he claimed he had always seen that the Soviet regime was endlessly hollow. Strangely enough, there's no record of Mailer ever having said that until Reagan vanquished the evil empire. To the contrary, in 1984, Mailer was cheerfully extolling the USSR as a free, church-going middle-class haven. Indeed, he wrote, "I do not know if I ever attended a Catholic service that was more intense." Mailer denied the existence of a police state, recounting how he would leave the hotel and walk around for miles without surveillance. Mailer jeeringly criticized American propaganda that portrayed the Soviet Union as an evil force. The Russians loved their children, too. But the way Mailer remembered it years later, it was conservatives who had been the naive ones because they bought the idea that the Soviet Union was an expanding empire. What did these conservatives have to go on, really? Sure, there were little telltale signs like the Soviet army marching through Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Mongolia, Turkmenia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Poland, Moldavia, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Albania, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, East Germany, Yugoslavia, North Korea, Cuba, South Yemen, Congo Brazzaville, North Vietnam, Guinea-Bissau, Cambodia, Laos, South Vietnam, Ethiopia, Angola, Mozambique, Nicaragua, the Seychelles, Grenada, and Afghanistan. But one could hardly call this a pattern. Elite opinion did not part company with Reagan on his methods alone. They disagreed with the goal of winning the Cold War, or quote-unquote winning, as sophisticates put it. Appallingly, America was the world's sole remaining superpower, and worse, America was going to win the war on terrorism. In 2003, Joan Didion morosely complained that the collapse of the Soviet Union had opened the door to the inevitability of American preeminence, a mantle of beneficent power that all nations except rogue nations, whatever they might say on the subject, were yearning for America to assume. As Didion saw it, the U.S. was harassing the Taliban and Saddam Hussein for no reason whatsoever. America's imminent military victory over terrorism, Didion said, was a dream from which there is no waking. On MSNBC, Doris Kearns Goodwin, historian and fact-checker for Joe Biden, also rued Reagan's triumph over the Soviet Union. She hearkened back to the good old days when we all lived under the threat of nuclear annihilation. At least with those two superpowers, there was a balance. There was a recognition that if one acted, the other would react, and there was some rationality in the minds of people. You know, but now the reaction against America being this superpower launching itself around the world, the anti-Americanism is probably higher than it's ever been. America's victory in the Cold War had taken all the sport out of global thermonuclear brinksmanship. Liberals expect everyone to forget not only what they said during the Cold War, but the fact that there was a Cold War, and that they were rooting for the other side. During Reagan's magnificent prosecution of the Cold War, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee unerringly awarded its prizes to Reagan's most maniacal opponents. In 1982, the prize went to Alva Merdl and Alfonso Garcia Robles for, as the Nobel Foundation put it, their magnificent work in the disarmament negotiations of the UN, informing world opinion, and arousing among the general public an acceptance of its joint responsibility for disarmament. In 1988, the Nobel Peace Prize went to the United Nations Peacekeeping Forces. Ronald Reagan never won a Nobel Peace Prize. Mikhail Gorbachev did. 20 years later, in the War on Terrorism, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee would again do itself proud. 1 month after the 9/11 attack on America, the Peace Prize was awarded jointly to the United Nations and Kofi Annan, who had once gushed that Saddam Hussein was a man I can do business with. As America prepared to attack in Iraq, at the end of 2002, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Jimmy Carter for his absurd objections to his own country's policies in the War on Terror. Whitaker Chambers wrote, "Other ages have had their individual traitors, men who from faint-heartedness or hope of gain sold out their causes. But in the 20th century, for the first time, men banded together by the million in movements like fascism and communism, dedicated to the purpose of betraying the institutions they lived under. In the 20th century, treason became a vocation whose modern form was specifically the treason of ideas." All of elite opinion was in a state of high anxiety throughout the Reagan years. At every turn, Reagan's policies and statements were said to be dangerous, promising a bleak future, frightening European leaders, and putting the world's survival at risk. Reagan was accused of engaging in lethal leapfrog with his simplistic view of the world. The New York Times even took shots at Reagan in the sports pages, referring to his macho myth of American supremacy. But now we're supposed to believe that these same policies were completely immaterial since the Soviet Union was collapsing with or without Reagan. For an irrelevant empire in decline, the Soviet Union sure prompted a lot of pointless hysteria. It cannot be that Reagan's approach to the Cold War was both horribly frightening and completely irrelevant. If the Iron Curtain was crumbling, American academics, reporters, editors, and the entire New York Times staff perpetrated a vast conspiratorial fraud on the American people throughout Reagan's presidency. Either that, or they were wrong and Reagan was right. Liberals lie about Reagan's victory because when Reagan won the Cold War, he proved them wrong on everything they had done and said throughout the Cold War. It is their last defense to 50 years of treason. Chapter 10, Cold War Epitaph, The Hiss Affair at the End of the Cold War. In the year 2003, the New York Times cheerfully announced the introduction of a new, lighthearted journal about communism. This is an ideology responsible for nearly 100 million murders, or as the Times put it, a divisive ideology. How about a lighthearted journal about suicide bombing or Nazism? Also divisive ideologies. Or must an ideology commit 10 times the murders of Hitler's Nazi Germany before liberals call it lighthearted? In the inaugural issue of the Lighthearted American Communist History, Robert Lichtman and Ronald Cohen wrote, "Is it ever justifiable in a democracy for the government to maintain a stable of paid witnesses to testify on its behalf about the political affiliations, almost always lawful and First Amendment protected, of individuals holding unpopular views? They won't quit. Paid agents of Moscow are described simply as individuals with unpopular views." Incomprehensibly, there is no stigma to having wittingly supported a totalitarian regime that committed monstrous crimes and had atomic weapons pointed at U.S. soil. In a stunning demonstration of the power